Hello and welcome to episode 40 of the Wilder Podcast. In this milestone 40th episode, we're reflecting on one of the most urgent environmental issues of our time, our rivers. We're joined by James Wallace, CEO of River Action, who offers clarity on the challenges, thoughtful solutions, and a deep reminder of the vital role rivers play in sustaining life on Earth. Chloe, hello.
Hello, Tom.
Should we start with apology?
We're late again.
We are. It's not even late. This is like, it's like, people might come for dinner and they'll turn up 15 minutes late. That's apologies for being late.
Yeah,
we're kind of 2 weeks late, which just basically just makes us bad people.
Or very busy people.
Yeah, that is true. And doing some really exciting things. So much is changing at the project. But before we go in, I'm aware that maybe sometimes some new listeners listening to this. So Chloe, would you like to introduce who we are and the project, please?
I'll try, Tom, but you do it so well.
Flattery won't get you anywhere, I'm afraid. And it's important to do things outside your comfort zone, Chloe. So
not on 9:30 on a Tuesday evening. That is not my favourite time, but anyway.
It is, 100%.
Okay. It's a Wednesday evening. Anyway, this just shows how tired I am.
Come on.
Okay, fine. Right. We are Tom and Chloe. We are the co-founders of The Grange Project and also husband and wife. And what is The Grange Project? It is a 80-acre farm, well, former farm in the Monmouthshire countryside. And we have a mission to achieve four things: to restore more nature, to produce more food, to contribute more to the local economy, and to connect more people to nature. So we're doing that with a range of different projects, from nature restoration or rewilding principles across the 80 acres we've got here, from a market garden, from a outreach and education centre in the form of the Grange Hub, through ecotourism, and welcome visitors from all walks of life to the project here.
It almost sounds like we know what we're doing.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
That has evolved over the last 40 episodes. There's some diehards that would have heard this evolve. If you're new here, you might sound like this has all been kind of wrapped up in a nice bow and we planned this from day one, but we very much, it's all about our journey as we learn and go along over 2 years now, speaking to amazing guests, helping to inform our thought process and our decisions. And this is what it's kind of evolving into, which is great fun to see and experience.
And on the subject of fantastic guests, this episode is an absolute cracker. James Wallace is a brilliant communicator, and it is such a critical topic that I'm so glad we've had the opportunity to dedicate our 40th episode to exploring this concept of rivers. And if you're wanting to jump straight into the episode, because at the start of each podcast, we normally give a little introduction about what we've been up to on the project. But for those that aren't particularly interested in that, you can find it in the show notes where to catch up with James's conversation.
I'm slightly embarrassed. We waited till episode 44. This is such an important topic. And I thought I kind of had a grasp on the challenges facing our rivers. But when you sit down with James and just talk it through from this logical thought process, it's terrifying, frankly, what's happening or has happened to our rivers. And I'm just so happy there's people like James out there fighting the good fight. I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him.
I'm glad he's working for this team.
Yeah, yeah. So really cool stuff. But before we get into that, let's do a bit of an update. Firstly, listeners will have, if they've listened to a couple of episodes recently, they'll have noticed that I've done a thing.
What thing have you done?
I've injected an advert into our episodes.
What's that thing?
Technological thing.
Yes.
We're getting to the point now in July where we're opening up the doors to people to come to stay at the project. And we've got to see these beautifully produced, built, sustainable cabins where you can come and stay. I won't go into it because I'm probably going to inject another advert into it, but please do consider it if you're looking for an escape. We'd love to welcome you here, and we'll talk more about it probably in a subsequent episode. Give me some updates, Chloe, of which there are many.
Where to start? Well, the one that is taking the most of our time at the moment, and these are all lessons learned in the journey, is our market garden, which is 2,000 square metres of former field, which has been transformed into a combination of 18 raised beds, 12 strip beds, and plans for a polytunnel and edible forest garden. Now, that transformation could not have occurred without some amazing volunteer support. So big shout out to ERM, our fantastic volunteer community, including the A-team that sneaked in an extra day to help us move the last 30 tons. We couldn't have done it without you. And we are now growing, or trying to grow, a selection of fantastic nutrient-dense fruit and vegetables that will serve all the guests that come to the project.
Yeah. And that, again, sounds really swept up and organised. What we didn't really appreciate is the fact we're essentially fast-forwarding into a drought. And this market garden is at the top of a hill, pretty far away from pretty much anything on the project. And we appreciated the importance of water, didn't we? So we put a pipe, a water pipe, all the way up there. We thought, great, we can water it. Slight problem is that the borehole it's connected to is not yet working because we haven't turned on the power there yet, and not for a few more weeks.
Thankfully, we have a water bowser and several watering cans, but it's taking about 2 hours of the day at the moment just to keep it topped up so we don't lose all our lovely veg.
I wouldn't say that we were embarrassed with the amount of time we had free before we had this, Chloe. So this is taking a considerable amount of time of our day. There are positives to it, which is the opportunity to kind of connect with nature while you're up there. Good for your arm and shoulder muscles as you're holding these watering cans.
And it makes you really appreciate the rain when it comes. I'm literally there measuring how much rain we've got. Does this mean I need some water or not? And to be fair, it is pretty cool seeing the little seedlings doing their thing, creeping through the soil, emerging into the world, and then also wondering why half of them are doing it and half of them aren't, and so why some are thriving and some not. But that's another podcast for another day.
Yeah, let's move on quickly before we lose you there a little bit. So what else we've been doing?
Well, I think a milestone for the project is last week we welcomed our first school visit. So we were absolutely delighted to bring the local primary school out here. We had 24 very excited children, complete with Flora, the forest fairy who lives in our tiny forest. They did an amazing range of activities from planting wildflower plugs to measuring our tiny forest trees and how well they're growing, doing some observational drawing of wildflowers and tree bingo. So I think we had perfect weather. It was a perfect day. I think the feedback's been brilliant and I can't wait to see more kids engaging with nature on the site.
And this is all part of your charity, isn't it? This is the Grange charity, which is, again, we'll talk about in more detail in the subsequent episodes. But so that nature connectivity is about bringing schools out, getting children into wilder nature, and also specifically as well, inner city schools that maybe, you know, don't get that opportunity very often as well, to get them out here and really embrace nature, get their hands dirty, maybe give your pig a scratch.
And I think for me, the main learning point, which is a kind of obvious one, but in hindsight, is that I was a bit panicky about them not having enough stuff to do. So I kind of scheduled quite a lot of activities.
That doesn't sound like you.
But the reality is what they wanted to do was look at the bugs, look at the trees and the flowers and the grass, enjoy being part of nature. And I should have definitely scheduled less. But that's a good learning point. And we're looking forward to welcoming many more groups in the future with that understanding.
So it's a pretty big day today as well. It was a momentous day, I would say, for me personally, for the project. The pigs have been enjoying about a third of the project while we've blocked them off from where the building work for the Grange hub is happening, but today we've just finished off the fence line with an amazing local company called the Wilcrick Group. I'm going to put a link to them in the show notes because they've been fantastic from day one and the work they've done is second to none. But now, even more importantly, is the pigs now have access to the whole project. So I went out this evening and tucked down all the fence lines, all the gates, all the electric fencing that's holding them in, and now tomorrow I'm very much looking forward to hopefully seeing them enjoying freedom again.
It's going to be really interesting to see whether they stick to their safety zones or whether we're going to have to encourage them out into the big wide world.
I don't think we need to worry.
There has been a few escapee incidents over the last month or so, so perhaps they were trying to tell us something. So the last update, because I know this has already been too long, but I just can't not tell you about how amazing it is that the bird life we've got here on the project at the moment. The swallows and the house martins have returned and it feels like the whole place is just humming with birds. We were joined last week by Nicholas, who is a member of the Gwent Ornithological Society, who came out to do a breeding bird survey here. And we found double the number of birds on the project this year than we did previously.
I didn't know that. And actually, I've been thinking in terms of the house martins and swallows, I was thinking in my head the number was, I think it's twice the amount we've had. Like, I genuinely believe that. So it's interesting that's correlated with the expert's perspective as well.
I was just sitting out this evening watching them and all the house martins have made nests out of the mud from the pond on the side of the house. So it's so cool to see the pond that we've created being used as material for the house martins' nests, and they were busy squabbling with each other about whose nest was whose and who was feeding whose babies. I presume that's what they're doing, but yeah, it was so cool to see.
Yeah, this is the first time they've built nests. I mean, I'm going to assume it's not going to damage the house.
I mean, the house has stood for 300 years, probably with many more house martins in its time.
But brilliant. Well, good to see. Shall we get into the chat?
Let's do that.
We've done the introduction at the top of the podcast, really. This is a true foundational episode about rivers. I couldn't get any better and we couldn't get a better person on to talk about it. So let's get into it. Please excuse this slight interruption to the episode. We will go back to the interview in about 10 seconds. But if you're looking to escape the modern trappings and go to the centre of a nature restoration rewilding project in South Wales, then do think about our new cabins. They're sustainably built, beautifully placed, and quite literally the only thing that's going to disturb you are the birds in the morning. If you want to have a bit of a weekend escape, then feel free to go to our website, grangeproject.co.uk. In the top right corner, it says stay with us, and you can book for this season. Now back to the interview.
Hello, James, and welcome to the Wilder podcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you both.
We're really looking forward to this episode because although we've kind of touched on the health of our rivers in previous conversations, it feels like a real privilege to dedicate a whole conversation to the importance of these amazing ecosystems and I guess the commitment of the communities that are trying to protect them. But before we get started, I'm wondering if you could introduce yourself and your journey to becoming CEO of River Action.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm James Wallace. I'm 52. I'm a father of two daughters, Flora and Annabelle, who are in their late teens, about to do their A-levels and GCSEs. I was born and brought up almost on the banks of a chalk stream, the River Pang, in 1972. The world was a very different place then from an ecological perspective, and our rivers were in a much healthier state. Yes, there was industrial pollution in the Midlands and the North, but where I came from, I remember clouds of butterflies. I remember kingfishers. I remember crystal clear water. And it wouldn't have crossed my mind to think of the word pollution. It's something that's come to my attention in much more recent times. But before I go into that, the journey, to answer your question, was a slightly unusual one to start with. I didn't really fit in when I grew up. I was kicked out of school. I had a very dodgy time with, well, let's say, chemicals in my system and really fell out of touch with society and nature. And it was by re-engaging with nature and also falling in love, as it happens, that helped me to pull myself out of the quagmire and really step back into society and to take responsibility for myself and my actions. I studied archaeology eventually without having had any A-levels, which in those days was possible, but certainly wouldn't be now. I was really interested in the dynamic between humans and the rest of nature. By that, I mean how we tend to, through our civilizations as they develop, to exploit and overexploit the natural environment around us. And we've done it many times over the millennia. And guess what? We're doing it now, but at a global scale. So my career was meant to head down the archaeological route and did for a little while. But then I had an accidental blip for 5 years working in a global corporation. It was a holiday job that went long. And I was really interested in corporate social responsibility because there was a considerable lack of it in those days. The term didn't even exist then. And I tried to introduce it in my organization, failed, so I left. Went back to school, went to Schumacher College in Devon, did a master's degree in holistic science, learned how the world really works. In other words, the qualitative as well as the quantitative ways of understanding the world, the systemic approach, combining things like nonlinear mathematics and chaos theory with systems theory and looking at how living systems work, how we can apply that knowledge to human systems. And that's really what I've done since. So the past 23 years have been setting up environmental enterprises that started with climate change communications, renewable energy and green finance and city centre regeneration, moved more into the countryside and agriculture, ecotourism. And then in the past 10 years has been wholly focused on conservation of water, initially the high seas, doing an expedition to Bermuda and submersibles, for example, working with tropical small scale fisheries in Madagascar, and then coming back to Britain and realizing that actually our own natural environment is in a terrible, terrible state, which I'm sure we'll be covering shortly, and have dedicated my career to helping solve the river crisis and the depletion of our wildlife and water shortages since, with the establishment of the Beaver Trust in 2019, and then the establishment of River Action with its founder, Charles Watson, for the past 3 years.
What an amazing introduction. Just hearing your story is such a reminder of the resource and the power of nature, but I guess at an individual level and a societal level. But yeah, that kind of complex question of how we've ended up in this exploitative relationship as opposed to a nurturing one, given the possibilities it presents to us at so many levels. But perhaps to get started, I'm going to ask a simple question, which I'm sure has a very complex answer, which is, well, what is the problem with our rivers?
Well, I mentioned industrial pollution. That, of course, still happens. And there are plenty of mines across the country leaking nasty chemicals. There's road runoff. About 18% of the pollution in English and Welsh waterways is from microplastics and the chemicals attributed to transportation and also urban runoff. Then you have agriculture and sewage pollution. And the agriculture generally across the country, on an average, is higher, contrary to perhaps popular belief. And that, of course, varies. If you're looking in the middle of London or Manchester or whatever, of course, it's going to be much more attributable to sewage. But generally speaking, agriculture is a very major issue. So let's start with that. If you look at the River Wye catchment, there are thousands of tons of excess phosphate every year that leach from fields, predominantly from the intensive poultry industry, or let's call them factory farms, because that's what they are, that are spread onto fields and wash off with the rain or snow or whatever, and then end up in over-nutrifying the river, which, as you may well know, leads to eutrophication. So effectively the snuffing out of life through a lack of oxygen and light. And then algal blooms. And those algal blooms and the, let's call it filamentous algae and other algae that form on the bed and the stems of plants and so on are foul in every respect. And its combined effect is a stinking brown slurry. So the River Wye has gone from being, and still is, a heavily protected river to one that not long ago was running crystal clear water with ranunculus, this beautiful, that some people refer to as maiden's hair, the sort of green water weed that flows down the river with white flowers on the surface at the right time, to having none, pretty much none left. The bird life depleted. Why? And fish life. Why? Because the insects and invertebrates can no longer survive in that deoxygenated environment. So really what we've seen with just one industry and the failure of a planning system and a lack of enforcement of the farming laws, we've seen the demise of a whole river catchment. Unfortunately, we're now seeing the same on the River Severn and on the River Usk nearby. And we could then go across the country. We could look into Wales and we could look at the dairy industry. Similarly, huge amounts of manure spread onto fields from these vast, you know, sometimes 500 or more cattle dairy herds that are just... The landscape can't cope with that much excess nutrients. And so tragically, many of Welsh rivers are struggling, and then combine that added pressure of sewage, which we'll come to in a minute. And then let's come to sewage. So when we have the Environment Agency's funding cut by 70% by the last government over 15 years, it's no wonder that water companies can be allowed to profiteer off what have done a terrible job of the financial regulation of the water industry. And instead of investing in cleaning up the mess that they've created, they've run to the hill with our money. And we're talking about many tens of billions of pounds worth of debt accrued at very high interest rates, and obviously dividends paid to shareholders as well. And that combined debt and equity return on investment has been at the cost of our rivers and indeed people's health, as we see many swimmers and rowers getting sick every year. And of course, the depletion of wildlife too. So those in my mind are the two main sources of pollution, but it's important not to forget chemical pollution from various sources, including road runoff as well.
It's a very depressing picture you just painted there in terms of the combined forces of all those different sources of pollution and the impact that's having on the rivers. And we live between the River Wye and the River Usk. We're part of the River Wye catchment. And certainly, even in the 15 years that we've been in this area, there's been a significant deterioration in the quality of the river. And I have plenty of friends who will not swim or kayak down the river now because of concerns for their health. And I suppose that leads me to my next question. If our rivers were to be protected, or we were to find the solutions to some of these complex problems, what would be the benefits of healthy rivers to the communities and the ecosystems around them?
Well, let's first look at where we stand in Europe. We are the most nature-depleted country in Europe. If you look at France, they have 565 approximately inland bathing water sites, so rivers and lakes. We have 15. That says it all, really. So if we look abroad, just across the channel for inspiration, we see lakes like Lake Annecy, which was in a dreadful state not that long ago, but by having a systemic catchment scale approach, they were able to reduce and often remove the combined impacts of sewage and agriculture on Lake Annecy, which, if any of your listeners have been to in recent times, they will see the water is so clear it reflects the sky's blue, and in fact the mineral content affects it too. It is absolutely jaw-breakingly beautiful. So that is what we can aim for. And when we look at, say, for example, chalk streams like the River Pang, where I was born and brought up, and the Kennet just over the hill, there are times of year when one can be fooled into thinking that that river's running clean because it looks clear. But then when one looks beneath the surface, we realize that there is a carpet of that algae I mentioned earlier. And when we look carefully, we also notice there's very few insects or fish. So when we look at how we heal the river system, we need to go to the point source or diffuse source of the pollution, the sewage, the agriculture, and so on. By managing that and treating that waste as a resource, I mean, dare I mention it, but rather than just chuck it on a field that doesn't need it, how about actually drying it, pelletizing it? In the case of poultry manure, it's highly nutritious in phosphates and nitrates and very valuable. Go to a supermarket or a garden center and buy a kilo of chicken poo and you'll see what I mean. It's very, very expensive. So this has value. Let's trade that. Let's take that excess from areas of surplus to areas of deficit. Rather than importing fossil fuel derived fertilizer from Europe, we can sustain ourselves and our fields. So the benefits are manifold. When it comes to agriculture, just imagine this. If we could pay farmers a fair price for their produce at the farm gate, and when I say we, I'm talking about intermediaries and predominantly supermarkets and fast food and retail outlets. So, for example, KFC, McDonald's, those sorts of brands, Nando's, who we've been targeting recently, pay the farmers a fair price. Government incentivize them. So with ELMS, imagine a situation where the government gives sufficient budget that farmers can then invest in riparian buffer zones. So in other words, giving a break between the fields and the runoff and the river and allowing wildlife to regenerate with beavers and otters and kingfishers and dragonflies. Imagine a grant that will pay for slurry storage and a trading system that will take excess manure and trade it from parts of the country to others. So that's agriculture. The benefits to us therefore mean that we have much higher likelihood of having happy farmers and clean rivers because the farmers are getting valued. And imagine a national food strategy and land use strategy that actually makes sure that we have removed and reduced at least our food insecurity, which is a very, very considerable issue. And the new Minister for Farming, Daniel Zeitner, is trying to work on this and trying to influence the NFU, for example, to work with him and organisations like ours to come up with a plan. And then look at sewage. Well, by having a removal of private interests from the rapacious vulture capital that is currently driving the behavior of water companies and replacing that with a blended finance model that we can learn from Europe, for example, where we have a combination of appropriate private investment alongside government investment, for example, bonds that have a much lower cost. Typically, private investment will go for 9 to 12% return. That's a very large amount of our bills paying wealthy investors interest. Whereas if a government-backed bond, you're looking at around 4%, something like that. And then imagine that investment going actually into clearing up the problem of not just combined sewage overflows, which leak all this untreated sewage, but also improving the quality of water that comes out of, in form of treated effluent, out of sewage treatment works. Currently, you're looking at very high levels of E. coli and other nasties that can lead to pathogens that make us really ill. And there's no need for that. If we look at Europe, the quality of water that comes out of water treatment works is much higher. That means we can then swim safely, we can row safely, we can walk our dogs, allow our children to paddle or for us to fish or so on without fear of getting a prick on our finger or a cut on our foot and getting sepsis or ingesting it and making it really us really sick. And then when it comes to the road runoff and city-based urban pollution, then similarly, imagine all those microplastics, those chemicals that are getting into the digestive systems of the insects and fish that also feed us often. And also, let's just not think about the rivers. Rivers lead to the sea. So the damage that's being done there is very considerable too. And just going back to sewage, let's not forget too, it's not just bacteria and viruses, but also very large quantities of pharmaceuticals, whether it's birth control pills that have hormones in, whether it's pharmaceuticals like paracetamol or antidepressants and recreational drugs of cocaine. You know, you may well be aware that there's very large quantities of these chemicals that are affecting the growth behaviors and sexual behaviors of invertebrates, amphibians and fish and so on, mammals too, in our rivers and seas. So you asked, what difference can it make? Well, all those problems can be resolved if we have a government that shows proper leadership and makes companies invest both in agriculture and in sewage and obviously transport too in cleaning up this mess.
I mean, I've been silent for this whole podcast so far, firstly, because I thought I understood, you know, a fair amount of what's happening. And what I've realized is, having listened to you for the last 15 minutes, is I haven't even scratched the surface when it comes to the effects on our rivers. So I'm doubly appreciative of you taking the time out to educate Chloe and I and our listeners. As you've said, this is not new. We've known this has been happening for a while. I'm just interested to get your take as to what's been getting in the way. Why haven't we created the systemic change required? What's in human nature that stops that from happening, because it makes sense. There's nothing that you said. I've gone, of course, everyone, who wouldn't want that to happen?
Well, I think there's a very significant lack of sense of urgency. Let's not beat around the bush here. We are on the cusp of running out of drinking water in this nation. Thames Water have done a piece of research a few years ago and again last year that demonstrates to their mind that for every day that London runs out of water, it will cost the economy £500 million every day, every single day. So when you hear from government or industry saying, oh, we can't afford to fix this problem, well, the cost of inaction, I would say, is much greater. Throw in climate change, throw in the fact that, just looking at London as an example, the chalk streams and the Chiltern Hills are drying up. 25% of them, I think, are now permanently dry, for example. So the lack of action there partly is a lack of sense of urgency. Across all of us, we take it for granted. We turn a tap on and water comes. We flush a loo and something unpleasant vanishes and is never, hopefully, to be seen again. Although, if you were looking out of the window of my house here in Aldbourne in Wiltshire, you would know that in the chalk landscape I live in, for example, near Lambourne, similarly in other villages nearby that your listeners may have heard about on the national news, we have a problem every year with sewage flowing down our main streets. And literally right outside my house, I've had sewage being sprayed against the wall of the building and against my car where my children get in and out of. So it's not a very pleasant situation. Why has that been allowed to happen? Well, a lack of regulation. I mentioned earlier about the 70% funding cut in the Environment Agency and the ineptitude of Ofwat. Well, combine those two things together. If you're a water company, then you just can pollute with impunity. You know that even if you do something bad, the likelihood of you going to court is very, very slim. And if you do, it'll probably be 5 or 6 years. So, for example, Thames Water, and I think it was 2017, around then, killed 1,500, 2,000 fish, somewhere between the two. It was only them. It could only ever have been them. There was no other source of pollution. And it took 6 years to prosecute. And the fine was £3.3 million. And you know, Southern Water did the same thing, pretty similar amount of fish. A year later, it took 5 years to prosecute. The fine was £330,000, a tenth of it. So look at the inconsistency there, neither of which are going to enthuse investors to put their money into fixing their assets. Instead, they're just going to run to the hills laughing, aren't they? I mean, that is a massive disincentive to clean up their mess. So we have a situation here where water companies have been allowed to pollute. There's been a lack of sense of urgency and pressure on the government. That is now significantly changing. There have been campaigners like River Action, Surfers Against Sewage, Windrush Against Sewage Pollution at a local campaign group not far from me who work nationally too. Ilkley Clean River, SOS Whitstable, Save Windermere, you know, the list goes on. Henley Mermaids, Friends of the Thames, and so on. These groups now are working together to try and make sure that people know about it. And that is why we saw in the election that the top environmental issue for voters was rivers and waters and the sea. Rightly so. The new government come in, they make all their commitments, but are they going to deliver? That's the question.
So I'm now doubly embarrassed and slightly indignant about what is happening, I think appropriately so. There'll be people listening now who have had their eyes open for the first time, like I have. You know, when you've painted this really gloomy picture, yes, there's strategic level or systemic things that could be changed, but what can individuals do, or what are individuals doing in order to do their bit to try and make this thing, turn this thing around?
Well, if you'd asked me that question in October last year, then I would have said, come and march for clean water on the 3rd of November, which we did with 15 to 20,000 people peacefully protesting, gathering in London outside Parliament and asking Steve Reed, the Secretary of State for Environment, for three things: to end pollution for profit, to enforce the law, and to reform the regulators. So what can we do now? Well, we can apply that pressure. The media, campaign groups like ourselves and others, and the general public both have voted in the summer for a new government and now need to hold them to account. We need to use all means necessary, whether that's through social media, writing to MPs, getting out on the streets and protesting, doing citizen science, whatever way comes to mind and you feel capable of making the time for and getting behind. Work with your friends and family, your neighbours and your community, and build that evidence base. That's why I mentioned citizen science. Measure the phosphates and nitrates, maybe even get an E. coli monitor and look at the levels of pathogens in the water level. To use that information then to tell stories of your own heartfelt concerns about your waterways locally, and to take that to your local media and your national media. to maybe even think about using the law too. There are people now who are taking action, legal action against water companies and the government to say they've had enough. Organizations like mine, River Action, are doing the same at a larger scale and with bigger budgets, where we are holding the government to account through something called the judicial review process, which is effectively saying to, for example, the Environment Agency, part of DEFRA, Department for Environment, to say, right, well, we have the farming rules for water, but you're not enforcing them. In fact, you never have since 2018 when those laws were put into place. So what happened in February last year, we took them to court and we had a general win. We didn't actually win the case because it turns out that the judge decided that we had been successful during the campaign. So he couldn't award to us. However, we succeeded. And now we're
What does that mean? Sorry, because I'm a big believer that actually we've got to start taking people to court and making it hurt, hit or hitting them where it hurts. So what does that mean that you won during the campaign? And
yeah, well, what we mean is that specifically we were saying that the guidance issued by DEFRA to the Environment Agency are responsible to go and inspect farmers and to hold them to account and say, right, you've got this much land, you're producing this much manure, you're spreading it, and it's too much or too little or whatever. Are you meeting or exceeding the needs of the land and the crop? And our concern was that this guidance from DEFRA to the Environment Agency was basically saying, don't enforce the law. I mean, I'm using very lay, simple terms, but our barrister and team successfully argued that point. And then the response from the government was to say, well, we'll tidy up our guidelines. And that's actually due to be coming out in March, by the way. The Office for Environmental Protection have been pushing for this, and we believe that revised guidance will be coming from DEFRA. So I mention this as an example because legal action doesn't necessarily mean winning the case. Although, of course, if you do, you may be able to set a legal precedent that can therefore be prosecuted by others in due course in similar situations, whether it's a water company, agriculture, or other sorts of pollution, doesn't matter. However, campaigning wrapped around legal actions in our mind is even more important. I'm bound to say that as a campaigning group, of course. But if we look at our successes and those of others like Fish Legal, the Good Law Project, Wild Justice and others, then you'll see the same. They will always, and we will always, build a campaign around a legal action. There's no point doing it otherwise. And in fact, I'm very happy to put tens of thousands of pounds of our hard-won money into paying for legal fees if we know that it's going to apply pressure on the polluter and the regulator and the government overall, which we successfully are doing, not just River Action, but others too. And so when we go back to the community question, what can you do as an individual? Well, for example, if you live on the River Wye, has the pollution on the Wye affected you and your family or your business? If it has, join the Lee Day case against Avara and Dŷr Cymru, the Welsh Water Company, which we are actively supporting, where over 2,000 claimants are coming together right now to sue. That's a very broad term. Specific terms don't really matter. It's statutory nuisance law, but we don't need to go into that. But to use the law against those two polluters, the farming polluter and the sewage polluter, to say, we've had enough. We're a, I don't know, let's say we're a B&B company and people are not coming to Hay on Wye anymore or coming to Monmouth or wherever it is you are, or rather Ross on Wye would be a better example, to say we've lost income and we can demonstrate we've lost income because of all the crap that you've put in the river. Or you might find on the River Thames that people are fed up with being sick as a swimmer or a rower, and they might wish to take individual legal action too against Thames Water and accuse them of a lack of a loss of amenity, for example. So there are various different legal forms. And on the citizen science side of things, there are organizations like Earthwatch who provide phosphates and nitrate tests to communities. And then there are online systems for registering that data. I mentioned E. coli testing. We do that and we help fund organizations and community groups to do it. And that's really powerful. If we look at the boat race last year as an example, we demonstrated that there were dangerously high levels of E. coli putting the rowers at risk on the Thames in Hammersmith Fulham area. And the national media coverage was 1,751 unique stories covering our organization and our campaign. It's unprecedented. Why was it so? Because guess what? We made a warning. We partnered with British Rowing and we issued guidance for safe rowing to those teams from Oxford and Cambridge. And not surprisingly, despite their efforts, three members out of eight of the men's eight were violently sick on the day, which was probably from training on the river. And the Environment Agency issued about the same week, their data for Thames Water and the rest of the water companies for their pollution, which was outrageously high. And Thames Water nearly went bust and then had to have a bailout. So it's like a perfect storm where you have a combination of community interest in the form of rowing clubs, the universities themselves, obviously, campaign groups like ourselves, the media, regulators, all this stuff coming together, an irresistible formula, if you like, for media. And consequently, the pressure we were able to put on Thames Water was massive, absolutely massive, and also on the government. And it was just before the election, of course. So we're pretty sure that this campaign affected the vote. It's hard to prove, of course, but we're pretty sure that all those different actions, Thames against Thames Water, will have affected Londoners and those people in the catchment. Likewise, Henley Regatta and other initiatives.
I really appreciate what you're saying, the kind of diversity of solutions and ideas and responses, which is needed whenever you have a complex systemic problem. And I have a real sense of momentum increasing. And I hope you feel the same. One of the questions that I have is, do you think that the regulations that are currently in place are sufficient and it's a case of enforcing them? Or do you think we need to be going beyond what is currently being regulated?
Well, it's a very good question. And before I answer that directly, I'll just quickly mention that all those things that I've just described that communities can do are in the River Rescue Kit that is launching on the 10th of March. And that is being delivered by River Action. And it is going to be an online platform that supports communities and activists to know what to do, where and when, and get support from people like us. As far as the regulatory frameworks are concerned, it's a bit of both. There are sufficient laws in many respects. I mentioned the farming rules for water. They should do what they're supposed to do, but it's the guidance that's been undermining them from DEFRA. It's also a lack of funding. The Environment Agency just don't have enough inspectors. It's a lack of training. Those farm inspectors do not have, it's called facts-basis training. It's effectively nutrient management skills to be able to assess the soil, the crop needs, and the manure that go onto those fields and see if they're out of kilter. And also there's a lack of data being exchanged between the various different agencies. So for example, the Rural Payments Agency that pay farmers their subsidies, if we call them that, does not share data with the Environment Agency inspectors. So if you go out to inspect, you may not have been trained as an inspector. You may not have access to farm herd size, cattle herd size and movement, and you might be going blind. So there's no wonder at all that you're not able to then, to your question, enforce that law, that regulation that's in place. And also we see with the funding cuts and the resource cuts, that also affecting our courts. So even if you do find yourself being handed a letter at some point from a regulator, which is very unlikely, that says, if you don't clean up your act, you're going to court, you'll probably know, if you look at the newspapers, that it's going to take years to prosecute. So you might just think, I'll carry on. And bear in mind, I'm not talking about here small farmers who are doing their best and struggling. And, let's not forget things like suicide rates in agriculture are horrific and terrifying. And those farmers, many farmers are really struggling to make a living. So to be very clear, River Action is wholly supportive of sustainable regenerative agriculture and those livelihoods. It is not supportive of factory farming in any way, shape or form, or the people who perpetrate it. And I say perpetrate advisedly. It is a crime that it's allowed to exist. And we'll be told that it's because people need cheap meat. That is a lie. People have become accustomed to vast quantities of unhealthy cheap meat, and that is very different to needing it. And it's certainly nothing to do with income brackets, because if you look at how much you pay on a KFC, it is certainly not cheap. You could buy 5 meals for the cost of that for a family. So it's a matter of education, of course, but it's not demand that's driving this, it's supply. This is a business model from Avara, which is otherwise known as Cargill in America, that has cut down rainforest, grows soy, force feed, sort of, maybe that's not the right word, but create a situation where chickens do not want to leave their feeders because they don't want to lose their spot. Fast-growing chickens for 5 weeks, slaughter them, and all that manure going into the river. That is a deliberate business model that provides very cheap chickens to supermarkets and KFC and all those groups. And therefore, the regulations here abjectly fail, Chloe. That's the problem. There is no regulation at all beyond basic animal welfare ones that actually prevents this sort of industry happening. And what we would really like to see is the government to smarten its act and actually intervene in the food and farming industry, both creating that national food strategy I mentioned earlier, and also making sure that farmers are growing healthy and ethically produced livestock that live longer lives, that are not polluting and are not causing huge damage or violence, you could say, to the animals themselves and to the landscape. And then when it comes to sewage and the water industry, the laws are there but are not enforced, and they should be changing. So I think it's fair to say that the farming laws are okay, but could be tidied up. Water company laws definitely need to be smartened up. And I'll give you examples. If you look at the regulator Ofwat, in the 1973 Water Industry Act, Ofwat were given the responsibility to make sure that rivers remained environmentally sound. That duty, environmental duty, was removed in the 1991 Act when the industry was privatized. So we actually regressed. That's not the first time or the last time. I know Liz Truss famously spouted on about cutting red tape when referring to farmers and farming and being very proud of it and water quality generally. Well, that time has to stop. We need not necessarily more red tape, but red tape that actually works. In fact, I don't even like that term. Let's forget it. We need laws that incentivize better practices. And for water companies, if you're being regulated by a body that isn't actually doing its job and doesn't have the teeth to do it, then you're going to carry on doing what you wish. And that is also like with farming, there's not enough inspections happening. There are not enough spot inspections. So in other words, unannounced ones. And there's an entire reliance on the water industry marking their own homework. They are doing self-monitoring. I believe, according to Windrush Against Sewage Pollution and others, there could be as much as a quarter or even more of outflows that are not currently mapped. So we don't actually know the true scale of pollution. And nor, when I say we, I mean the government too. And then the water quality itself, permitting has not been updated in many cases since the 60s. So if you're a water company, the water standard that you're producing, final treated effluent, I mean, so sewage comes in one end, watery substance comes out the other, then that is not being considered. And it's not being considered with the massive population growth we've seen since those 60 years, maybe more or less, depending on your permit. And it hasn't been considered in terms of climate breakdown, flooding, drought, and so on. And of course, the changes in what's in our system when it comes to the chemicals I mentioned earlier and sewage and so on. So we need water company permits changed and updated for each sewage treatment work and water company's permit to trade, to operate. There's a significant piece of legislation that has never been used against the water industry, and that's called the Special Administration Regime, SAR, or SAR for short. Special admin, as people refer to it, could be used and arguably should be on organisations like Thames Water, who have not only failed financially and are on the brink of bankruptcy, but have failed environmentally and for their customers and are called to the new government. And there's a water commission that some of your listeners might be familiar with that has been announced just recently, is to say to the water commission and the commissioner himself, Sir John Cunliffe, let's see the law being enforced. Let's see the environmental agencies and regulators probably combined. Let's have a much more efficient way of doing things. And let's use things like the SAR regime, the special admin regime, to hold those polluters to account and take them out of private hands. We're never going to see a change in the way water companies behave if they remain there operating for the benefit of shareholders and creditors. We need to see a blend where we look to Europe and we learn from across the channel to see how we can combine for-profit and not-for-profit investment with proper municipal oversight. And by that, I mean both at the local level and national, where you have a national plan for water quality and water quantity, and that is administered by the regulators and the government. And at a local level, let's say Thames Water and Mayor of London. The Mayor of London has a plan for swimmable rivers by 10 years' time, so 2034, 35. How is he going to achieve that if he has absolutely no influence over Thames Water, the main polluter? How about putting him or his representative on the board of the company? Or another means, it doesn't have to be that way, but a municipal authority on this, having a seat on the board of the biggest polluter and the provider of water to 15 million people. Apply that to other water companies and also customers too. And then we'll have a much better chance of those regulations that we feel have been failing to have a better chance of success.
I completely agree with you. It's completely bonkers that we've created a system where essentially we're valuing profit more than clean drinking water. When you think about it on that level, it just makes absolutely no sense. From what you're saying, it feels like if you look at all those different levels, the media attention, the community action groups, the legal battles, the campaigning work of River Action, it does feel like the kind of appetite for change does feel really strong. And I feel that maybe that's not just within our environmental bubble, but beyond that now. How would you assess the current political will to enact some of these changes?
Well, since the election, the new government, the Labour government, have been saying a lot of the right things in that they have a new water bill that's had King's Assent and ostensibly is there to fix the problem with the water companies. But really, banning CEO bonuses, is that going to dissuade them? They'll just increase their base salary. The threat of imprisonment, that's just if they withhold evidence. It's not for polluting. So that's not going to happen. So I think we're seeing a bit of tinkering around the edges, a bit of fluffy sort of political movement. There is the Water Commission that I mentioned, and that is due to report in the end of June. And I would hope we will see something towards what I've and my colleagues and other activists have been asking for in a complete overhaul of the way water companies are financed and governed and regulated. But I'm afraid we don't hold much hope for that actually really happening. When you have the power of international investment markets, that's what the government care about. Some of the first meetings that the Secretary of State for Environment, Steve Reed, had after election was with the GIIA, the Global Infrastructure Investment Association. That represents, I think it's about 25 of the world's biggest infrastructure funds. And they are all putting massive pressure on the government. And then we have Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer saying growth, growth, growth. Well, our argument is if you want economic growth, how about protecting the environment? It's an enabler. Rivers do not need growth. They enable it. When I say rivers, I mean clean, healthy rivers. So what we would like to see is a situation where the new government delivers on what we hope the Water Commissioner will recommend, if he is to recommend along the lines that we are asking. If he doesn't, then we will be making a lot of noise about it. Who knows? Maybe there'll be another march. Maybe there'll be other tactics deployed. We will continue pursuing new legal challenges. Just today, we've announced a new challenge against the price review. It's called PR24. We've just started a pre-action process for a judicial review targeting Ofwat, because we believe that the price, this is about bills for customers. We believe the process was done illegally. I won't go into the details. We and our legal team are convinced that we have a strong case here, and hopefully a judge will agree with us. So we're going to continue pursuing legal actions. We have more up our sleeves coming soon. And what we really need to see is Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves sitting down with Steve Reed and saying, here you go, here's some cash. Because I'm afraid the commission is not going to be able to make much difference if we still have this nonsense talk, insane talk about growth, economic growth, in a finite world which is literally on fire and flooding simultaneously, rampant with disease, people being displaced all over the place. Who knows when it's Britain's turn to move north and so on. And rather than that, we should be investing in our waterways, protecting wildlife, protecting the lifeblood of our land and our economy, rivers.
I want every MP to listen to this episode because it's exactly what I hope to get out of these interviews is I want the ground truth. I want someone to come in who knows it inside and out and communicate it directly with plans and with solutions as well. I really value someone who tells it as it is. I get a little bit frustrated when we talk about these challenges and everyone beats around the bush and doesn't want to upset too many people. And let's not say things that might upset people on both sides, people that care about the environment and vice versa, because it's a very emotive thing. I think I'm going to have to sit down in a dark room after this and have a really good think, because it is that terrifying from my perspective. But the point is, you've given me so many options and ways that I can get involved that I'm really excited by. And I'm looking forward to the release, was it later this month, of the new platform, the website. I'm going to have a really good look at that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear it. And in fact, you've hinted at restrictions that people kowtow to the status quo. Well, there are vested interests. There are, unfortunately, organizations within my sector that are somewhat hindered in how much they can speak out against the hand that feeds them by taking funding from polluters or government. Now, that doesn't cover all by any means. There are plenty who take money from government and take legal action against them. But there are some who feel it's difficult. And I feel that's a bit of an issue, a frustration, let's say, and more than a bit. It's a massive issue. There are organizations, and when I say organizations, we could be talking about informal community groups. I mentioned Windrush Against Sewage Pollution. They're a perfect example, who are, you know, founded by a retired mathematician and detective who have taken it upon themselves to try and really find out about the underlying issues within the water and sewage industry. And my goodness me, they have done incredible work. Peter Hammond and Ashley Smith, and they've built a team around them now. They help people all over the country to uncover the truth. And they are very well known to the government and to the industry that they are targeting, and probably not just respected, but feared, because they uncover the truth. They literally dig in a way that is highly respected and evidence-based and is hard to challenge. Having said that, frustratingly, we haven't had always the greatest response from the polluters and government when we've produced our own evidence. So, for example, E. coli testing on the River Thames ahead of and during and after the Henley Royal Regatta last year in 2024, we were referred to as being alarmists by Thames Water. They didn't like our E. coli results because they contradicted theirs. Ironically, though, ours were done and the testing locations were right by the source of pollution. Theirs weren't. Not surprisingly, ours were much higher. So when we produced our results, they accused us of stirring things up and being unscientific. When I actually met Catherine Ross, one of the directors of Thames Water, in their lab very shortly afterwards with a BBC film crew, she admitted that perhaps they may have misread the situation. But did they do a public correction? No, of course not. So you'll find that even with evidence, and all those things we've talked about that the River Rescue Kit's going to be helping to deliver, that doesn't necessarily mean the government or industry are going to change. That's why we have to keep going on the streets. We've got to keep using the media. We've got to keep peacefully, but vocally pressuring and reminding the elected leaders of our country and those business leaders too, who hold the decisions and power to enable this change, that there is nothing more important to everything in our lives than clean water. Literally nothing more. You might, I suppose, put air and soil alongside it, but these natural resources, if we were to call them that, are enablers of everything we do. And that is why I'm focusing my life on this right now.
I think this is one of those interviews that is going to sit with us for a long time. And I really appreciate your expertise, your clarity, and how you've kind of communicated a very complex issue and distilled it down to some really clear examples. So thank you so much for the time that you've taken, James. I know that we're going to put details of the River Rescue Kit in the show note for anyone that's interested. And where else would we signpost people to that have heard this conversation and feel as impassioned as I do about taking action?
Well, riveractionuk.com on our website. River Action UK on social media. We're on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and X. And also, the River Rescue Kit is found through our main website or directly. So if you Googled River Rescue Kit after the 10th of March, you'll find it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
There is so much to take away from this conversation in terms of understanding complex problems, complex solutions, hear momentum of a movement. James communicated so much information so clearly, I thought, in that 40-minute chat. And we actually recorded this conversation a couple of months ago, and it's been one of those things that's kind of been percolating with me. And I was sat out by the River Mono on Sunday, and I was thinking about what a critical role rivers play for us as humans, as well as for the ecosystem. It was so lovely because there was the ducks down in the river, the swans had their cygnets. There were people of all ages, from a much older generation sitting and watching the world go by, right down to our two-year-old sort of poddling by the side of the river, through to some teenagers were sitting having their coffee and hanging out. And I just thought how important they are and how embarrassing and sad it is that we've let them get into a state where I wouldn't let our little one paddle in the stream anymore because of the risk to her health.
I mean, I'm no expert, but as we were looking at it, it was yellowy, wasn't it? It looked unhealthy. And I think, like you've said in previous episodes, I think it's that subconscious. And maybe the people that are sitting there are enjoying it and think that's normal. They think it's a normal, healthy river. But subconsciously, something in the back of your brain will be going, there's something wrong here, discordant here. What's going on? I trust and believe that James and the team at River Action and all the other organizations he spoke at are going to drive the change that we need. But, oh, it's desperately needed.
It was really making me think about that notion of shifting baseline syndrome. I'm sure most people are familiar with it, but this kind of idea that we don't know what we've lost because we don't have that kind of sense of historical context. But as I was watching everyone appreciating the space, I was just kind of wondering about how powerful it would be if it was teeming with, you know, otters and beavers, and I mean, I know I've got those, the kind of big hitting animals, but like even just healthy plant life or fish, or if we had all that, how much better it would be for our souls as well as for the ecosystem.
And not only that, we were there when it was a hot day and nobody was in it because probably people knew, but could you imagine if everyone was in there and they were splashing and having fun and frolicking? But it's just, yeah, one of many things that we need to address as humans, but yeah, certainly gone up my priority list.
I think it's a really good point there about how I left this episode with that. I thought James really effectively balanced, I mean, a lot of people might know there's a quite a famous climate change podcast called Outrage and Optimism. And I felt this is a really classic example of them's outrage is absolutely the word for how we've treated our rivers and the multiple systemic factors that have kind of led to their deterioration. But also there was real optimism in the conversation about the change that's happening, the momentum behind it, the levels of shift that's occurring from individual community groups, politicians, River Action campaigning work. It just feels like there's an opportunity for something exciting to happen with enough public will that will hopefully translate into political will.
And just a reminder that all the key links that James talks about during the interview will be in the show notes for you to peruse at your leisure. Right. I think we've come to the end of the episode.
Yeah. Big thank you to James, and hopefully everyone's left more informed and more energized to take action on this critical issue.
And if there are any topics that people do think we haven't covered yet and are critical that we just have a blind spot for or whatever, then please feel free to email us. It's hello@grangeproject.co.uk. It goes to both Chloe and I, and we will endeavour to do our best to address some of these topics.
Yeah, and thank you so much to the people that have reached out recently. It's so lovely to have your emails, and I know a number of you are coming to visit the project in the next few weeks. So yeah, excited to meet you and excited to hear about the impact these conversations have had on your thinking.
All right, let's get back to working.
Yeah, let's do that.